Thank you so much, Maria, and welcome everyone. I am Diana Burgess, and I'm a core investigator at the VA Minneapolis Healthcare System and the director for the Query Complementary and Integrative Health Evaluation Center, or CHEC, along with Executive Director Dr. Stephanie Taylor and Co-Director Stephen Zellian. And CHEC is a partnered evaluation center working with the Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation. As part of CHEC, we run this monthly CIH Cyber Seminar Series, which has an amazing lineup of great speakers and a broad range of attendees. And today, I'm very excited to introduce you to Dr. Diana Whitham. Diana Whitham is a clinical research nutritionist at the Rocky Mountain Mental Illness Research Education and Clinical Center, MIREC, and an assistant professor in the departments of physical medicine and rehabilitation and psychiatry at the University of Colorado and Schultz School of Medicine. Dr. Whitman has her doctorate in human nutrition, a master's of public health in epidemiology, and is a registered dietitian. Her research focuses on nutrition-related behaviors in veterans with polytraumatic injuries, and in particular, the intersections between nutrition, psychosocial determinants of health, and integrative approaches to psychosocial rehabilitation. And in addition to our speaker, we're always really pleased to have a representative from the Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation, who is our operational partner in CHEC and attends the CIH seminars monthly to give a short reflection on what you've just heard during the presentation and can provide some comments on how this fits in with their office's policy and practice and what the VA is doing in the space. And today we have Dr. Janet Clark, who is the Senior Physician Lead, National VA Program Office Leader in the Office of Patient-Centered Care. So now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Whitman, whose talk is entitled, What is Nutritional Functioning? Redefining Food Insecurity and Identifying New Avenues of Integrative Care.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Dr. Burgess. So yes, I'm Diana Whitham. I do want to note, just to make things more complicated, that I publish under Diana Brosto. If I show publications and say, look what I did, they'll say Brosto on them instead of Whitham. And let me see, let's get this to the slides to go. There we go. So my usual disclaimers and disclosures, I am funded by the Office of Research and Development. I have no conflicts to disclose. So the agenda is, I'm going to try to speed through the first several items about food insecurity and kind of where we've come from and new emerging contexts, and then get to what I really want to focus on is sort of where we are now in these new directions in nutrition, not just in the context of my work, but food security in the VA in general. But first, poll question, just to get a feel for things, how familiar are you with food security as a concept? And I believe, Maria, you have like a poll. Ah, there we go.
And that poll is currently open. Please go ahead and respond to the following. How familiar are you with food security? Is it A, not at all? B, somewhat familiar, but I don't encounter it much. C, somewhat familiar, I occasionally encounter it. D, familiar, I regularly address it in my work or practice. Or E, very familiar, it's a major focus of my work or practice. Once you made your selection, go ahead and click submit, and I will go ahead and share that poll in a few minutes, a few seconds, actually. Mm-hmm. So let's see, we have a couple people that are still in progress. Once they answer, I will go ahead and close it. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and... What? We got to jump here. Oh, sorry that a lot of people are still responding. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close that poll and share the results.
Leave it to me to make a complicated five-part poll question.
And then let's see. And the answers are, we have 1% said A, not at all. Sure. We have 13% say they're somewhat familiar, but I don't encounter it much. We have 29% that said C, somewhat familiar. I occasionally encounter it. And we have 18% that said familiar. And then 10% said very familiar.
So that gives me, I appreciate it. It gives me an idea of where people fall on that. It's a topic that, most of us have heard at least in passing, but there's a lot of different aspects to it. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Me see if I can advance the slides again. So my objectives for you today really are to have a better idea of how our understanding of food insecurity has changed over the years, because it's really changed quite a bit, I would say, even in the last 5, 10 years. See food insecurity within a larger socioeconomic and cultural context, and then really kind of drill down a bit into what veterans' unique challenges are. And then lastly, understand how nutrition in integrative and complementary care is changing, and that there are a lot of different exciting avenues of intervention and research that can take place in this field. So where we've come from, briefly, these are very stereotypical images. When you say food insecurity to a layperson, they're going to think of hunger. They're going to think of things like food stamps. They're going to think of people who are not housed. These two images on the lower right, I would say in the last 20 years, more research started coming out about, did you know that people who are food insecure don't make good food choices and eat calorie dense, but low nutrition foods? And then it's been tied to things like body weight and discussions of obesity. I don't like this final image, but I put it there because that's what some people also think of when you talk about food insecurity, is that there's a certain body shape associated with being food insecure. So just to, again, to give a bit brief background on where we're at, is these are data from 2022. The USDA monitors food insecurity nationwide, and just shy of 13% were food insecure. So this is after the height of the COVID pandemic, and food insecurity, as they define it, is uncertain or unable to acquire enough food to meet the needs of all their household members because they had insufficient money or other resources. The takeaway there is that it's a very economic definition. Did you have money for food, and did you have enough money for food? Of those 17-ish million, just shy of 7 million were categorized as having very low food security. The USDA will also categorize sort of being food insecure or being very food insecure. So, and that's where normal eating patterns were disrupted and food take was reduced at times during the year. That's another way of saying people went hungry at some point. Demographics, so there's these different kind of umbrellas for statistics of food insecurity. So demographics, none of these should be surprising. Food insecurity tends to disproportionately affect minors, the elderly, ethnic and racial minorities, people with lower educational attainment, single parents, especially women-headed households, single-person households in general. So having a partner and another income would be protective. That makes sense. The economic aspect is when it comes to things like government assistance are predicated on income, which again, a lot of us already know. So the current federal poverty levels for a single person household is just over 15,000. This is per year in income. And for a household of four, it's $31,000. I don't know where everyone is today calling in from today. I live in Denver, where the average rent for a one bedroom is, pushing $2,000 a month. So you can very quickly end up spending a lot of your money on housing. This picture here is of a family that is essentially living in a hotel. Some people would qualify that as homelessness or unstable housing. We're finally acknowledging that homelessness isn't just street homeless because of the cost of housing. And that is also tied to things like employment, especially fluctuating employment. I'm not even getting into what happened to employment during the COVID pandemic. And then spending trade-offs, childcare, food, rent, transportation, medical care. If you are a clinician, you've probably heard treat or eat. So people who play a little math game with themselves of, do I buy my medication or do I eat? Do I save my insulin and make it last longer by eating less? These kinds of things are very common in kind of an economic view of food security. And then general health. This, again, none of this is surprising. Having inconsistent or inadequate access to enough food is going to affect things like the immune system, inflammation, your risk for heart disease, your risk for metabolic diseases like diabetes, hypertension, your overall health status, your quality of life. All of those things can be diminished or worsen when you are food insecure. And then environment. I'm kind of flying through these to get to the meat of the matter, is probably most of you have heard of the term food desert, which is that you live somewhere where it's either very difficult or a long distance to get to a food store. And there's, again, many ways of measuring it, lots of research being done in this space, but we tend to think of things like urban food deserts. So this is a picture in here in North Denver, where here is a major freeway, here is a small food bodega, there is no major grocery store in this neighborhood. And then across the highway, so if you walk under that highway, is a whole residential neighborhood. And so they have to either scurry under the highway or find some other way to get to that store for food. Suburban places we don't think of as having difficulty acquiring food, but it really depends, especially here out west where you have these large developments that pack in a lot of housing, and there may be, you know, one Walmart supercenter on either side of town or something like that, where it can still be a distance or a difficulty. And then rural, this is very intuitive that people in rural areas often have to drive great distances for food. And I'm giving you a broad overview. This is a much more nuanced topic. But I did want to touch on it. The USDA defines food deserts as, if you live in an urban area, do you have to go over a mile to the nearest grocery store? If you live in a rural area, do you have to go over 10 miles? And these green splotches on the map are what are considered food deserts in the USDA map. So where we are now, we're in a new context. We're really moving past this notion, this binary understanding of food insecurity is, do you have money for food? Yes or no. It's much more nuanced than that. So you may have seen some of these terms. People like to get creative, food oases. That's basically saying you're food secure, you live in good proximity to food. Food swamps is you live in proximity to enough food to feed yourself and you're able to feed yourself, but the food is poor quality. Nutrition security, this one is something that I have a lot of interest in. In some spaces, it's replacing the concept of food security, because nutrition security is not just, do you have consistent access and is it affordable, but it's also, are these foods that are culturally appropriate, they promote well-being, they prevent disease, and they are especially available to people who are historically marginalized in their access to food. Rural, remote, tribal, lower income. Food sovereignty is one that also is getting more attention, and that's really the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food. And it's also for the right of people to define their own food and agriculture systems. So that an example of that would be, I did my graduate training at the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities, and there are different indigenous reservations and communities in northern Minnesota, and they have are doing a lot of work around kind of reclaiming their food sovereignty. There are indigenous foods that they grow there, consume there, and instead of it being sidelined as, well, that's just something that you like to eat for celebrations or something, it's like, no, this is a core part of how they define good nutrition for themselves, and that is valid. And then culinary heritage. You know, we all grew up with some kind of a culinary heritage, even if it was Wonder Bread and mayonnaise. We all have a heritage. So let's see. Oh, ready to do that. So what do all of these relate to? What does this all mean? I like to think of it through the lens of social determinants of health. Many of you have probably seen some iteration of this model, where these different aspects like economic stability, education, your environment, your social context, and food, all of that collectively determines your health outcomes. Not just how long you'll live, but what your quality of life will be like, your functional status, all of those things. Again, you're probably quite familiar with this by now. I like this definition by a social scientist at York University. Social determinants of health are where you work, how reliable your work is, how safe your working conditions are, how much money you have, whether your housing is secure, your gender, whether you are disabled, whether you have secure access to good food, the cost of food, and whether you are a member of a minority group. It kind of encapsulates all of those things. So another way of looking at it, if you take nothing else from today's talk, is that I like a visual model. Another way of looking at it is stress, especially when it comes to veterans. Stress and how different social determinants of health kind of enter this wheel of stress when it comes to food insecurity. So we've talked about things like income, spending trade-offs. Do I pay my phone bill because I need that for work, or do I eat? Healthcare expenditures, employability, chronic illness, and then the coping strategies are something that I focus a lot on. So your dietary quality, your eating behaviors, and your bandwidth. Bandwidth is really like, what am I, not just physically and financially, but what am I emotionally capable of doing right now in terms of my eating choices, given this kind of self-perpetuating wheel of stress that a lot of people experience. And again, this is pretty intuitive. I spend a lot of time, I feel, as a nutritionist, stating things that are hello, Captain Obvious, but it's really about contextualizing them and bringing them into different settings. So this is another way to look at it. This is something I created a few years ago when I was still kind of trying to see where the state of evidence is for food insecurity. We've talked about demographics and economics and environment and general health. And here we're getting to my core interest, which is those psychiatric factors and how they affect veterans. So where we're at right now with that research is, you know, we tend to say like, yes, it makes sense that somebody who is depressed, let's say, isn't eating very well, however you define eating well. But the body of research is really growing about how intrinsically correlated they are. So if for people with a mood disorder, a schizoaffective disorder, a substance abuse issue, have a history of suicidal ideation, they are significantly more likely to experience food insecurity. And that works longitudinally and bidirectionally. So there is now more evidence about developing depression puts you at an increased risk for becoming food insecure at a later date, as well as the bidirectional aspect. This is a smaller body of research, but there are data showing that people who have a mood disorder and are food insecure, if you address food insecurity, their depressive symptoms will improve. That these things are so tied, not just because of whether or not they're physically able to meet their food needs, but because of the emotional burden of worrying about food. Will I get enough food? Where will I get the food? How will I pay for food? Especially if they're also supporting people in their households. So veteran populations, because we haven't talked about veterans yet. So veterans, these are data from 2021, 1.8 million, so just over 11%. Were considered food insecure by the USDA. Of those, just shy of 900,000 had very low food security. So they were reporting regularly skipping meals, going hungry. And I want you to, I hope for you to kind of keep those numbers in mind, because they're an appalling statistic, in my opinion, but they also don't tell the whole story, because it can get much more nuanced than that, as with everything. Overall, veterans are slightly less likely to experience food insecurity than non-veteran counterparts. If you recall, previous slide, I said about 12-ish% of Americans nationwide, but they are much less likely to enroll in food assistance programs. They're much less likely to enroll in SNAP or WIC or any of those things. And then also, these, I just had to put this in because the paper literally came out this week. Over a quarter of active duty service members are food insecure, compared to about 10% of matched civilians. So that's a whole separate issue that know was for someone else to address, but I thought that was worth noting. And I came to this topic, you know, as a nutritionist in my graduate training, I was working in cardiovascular disease, and I was looking at aging populations. And I found data sets that showed that even after adjusting for income, so regardless of whether veterans had money in their pockets, what really predicted there being food insecure was depression and then a functional limitation, so physical mobility, those activities of daily living, the ADLs. If that was impaired, then they were multiple times more likely to experience food insecurity. And then during the pandemic, I did kind of a point in time study. This was the height of lockdown with post 9/11 veterans, and again, who have a lot of comorbidities, a lot of injuries. And again, after adjusting for income, it was really that combat history, that PTSD, the mood disorders, for some reason, stigma about that they anticipated experiencing if they were to become infected with COVID was highly correlated with food insecurity. So a lot of social emotional things going on there. And then I have some wonderful colleagues in the VA who are also looking into food insecurity. And just in the last few years, a couple of papers have come out on suicidal ideation. I work at the Rocky Mountain MIREC. Our mission is suicide prevention among veterans. And I think to some people, it may seem like an extreme jump, like, oh, you don't have enough food. How would that correlate with wanting to end your life? But they do. So veterans who are food insecure consistently are at much higher risk of suicidal ideation compared to food secure veterans. It's not the reason that you can't draw a straight causal line, obviously, but it's important enough to where it shows up over and over again in the data. This is all to say that why people eat what they eat is complicated. You know this intuitively, but it really hasn't been that long in the research that we've really tried to quantify the where and the why and the how. So I'm going to reframe again another visual model. This is, if you're familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, this is sort of a take on that came out several years ago now, where you have this pyramid of like, from enough food, is it acceptable? Is it reliable? Does it taste good? Is it novel, meaning do you get to try new things? And then instrumental. Instrumental is, it's kind of reflected here again on this slide, not to confuse things. Instrumental is I eat the foods I eat because I believe that they confer a health benefit or are somehow associated with how I view my bodily function or my cognitive function or spiritual function, however you want to quantify it. I want to make a couple key points about this, is that we tend to think of these kinds of hierarchies of needs as a person at any given moment is at a certain place on the pyramid. And I can't speak to other kinds of pyramids, but when it comes to food values and food needs, I would argue that people travel up and down this pyramid all the time. And I'll tell you why in just a moment. But this is, you know, am I hungry has been the food-related question that has driven human society for millennia. And now we are seeing much more of, am I the kind of person who would eat this kind of food values, where your food choices are almost a statement about who you are. To some degree, that's always been part of human history. We've always signaled our social status or what have you through what we eat, but I feel like now it's much more obvious. So hopefully that wasn't too confusing. The reason I bring this up as well is because in my clinical practice, I used to work in our homeless domiciliary here in Denver. So these were inpatient veterans who were in a program to obtain housing. So by definition, unhoused, by definition, food insecure. And part of my job was preparing them for graduation to independent housing and maintaining independent housing and caring for themselves. And so I would often do a class where I would have a whiteboard and say, okay, why do you eat? And they'd all say, because I'm hungry. I was like, yep, that's a good reason to eat. Why else do they eat? And sometimes it would stump some veterans, like, well, because you need to eat, because that's what you need to do to live. I'm like, absolutely. Is there any other reason to eat? And sometimes there would be some hemming and hawing. And finally, I would say, have you ever eaten because you're bored? Have you ever eaten because you're sad? Have you ever eaten because it was there? And why not? And then it would kind of get the juices flowing. And so, you know, we tend to think of emotional eating as having a negative connotation. Oh, that's emotional eating. You know, I ate my kids' Easter candy because I was having a hard day. That's bad. That's emotional eating. But we all eat emotionally. And so over the course of, you know, a class with veterans who, again, are food insecure, are trying to obtain housing, you would think that they would be at the bottom of that pyramid. And they sometimes saw themselves as being at the bottom of that pyramid of like, am I hungry? Yes or no? Do I have food? But really the reasons they eat things can be much more nuanced than that. And just like everybody else, they see information in the media, they talk to peers, they have things about food that they think are important or not important, they have goals relating to their diets. It would be easy and dismissive to say that, well, they're food insecure, so if we just give them food or money for food, that solves everything. No, people are unfortunately much more complicated than that. So all of these factors, these finances, demographics, health conditions, mental health, all these different things I've gone over, and after seeing the data on mood disorders and functional limitations in veterans, I started to think, okay, so what does this look like in veterans who have a very unique set of experiences? And what would I call that also? So I'll get to that in a second. I focus on veterans with polytrauma, so post 9/11 veterans, because it's a very complicated population. In case you're not familiar with the definition, polytrauma in the VA means at least one mild traumatic brain injury, because it's the signature injury of post 9/11 veterans, and at least one associated comorbidity. So a lot of them will have a mood disorder and PTSD, chronic pain, they all have those. Pardon me, a lot of them will have vestibular disturbances. So those are things like dizziness or balance issues, cognitive, auditory, visual, spinal, all of those things. So I asked, how are veterans using food? Where and how are they getting it? How do they pay for it? How are their injuries impacting their ability to acquire and prepare and consume food? How do they feel about the injuries in a nutritional context? How does their background inform their values regarding food? And a lot of them had very strong opinions. So I'm finally actually at nutritional functioning, which is what I'm calling it for now until I think of something a little more pithy. And I base this, I'm throwing another conceptual model at you. If you work in rehabilitation medicine, we tend to view all health conditions through this model of, you know, the body functions, the activities, how you participate in life, your personal factors and your kind of external environmental factors, all of these kind of work together to determine how well you function, whether this health condition is polytrauma or a spinal cord injury or diabetic neuropathy or whatever, what have you, all of these things go together. If you ever want a fascinating read, you can go on the ICF website and they have codes upon codes upon subcodes for every single iteration of every single body part and function that can go into these different domains. And so what I started with was, you know, this is the same model, but I took polytraumatic injuries and I went through all these codes and I said, what is related to food? What are all the codes in rehabilitation related to food? And they were biting, chewing, just food itself, eating, shopping for food, preparing food. These are all very important, but the main focus of them is the physical act of feeding yourself and the physical act of making food to feed yourself, which again are at the core of impairments for some veterans. But then I thought, well, what about that mental health aspect? And so these are postulated. This is not to give you some fun reading, but this is just, there's so many different codes. I thought, okay, well, what about chronic pain? What does chronic pain in your back have to do with food? Maybe nothing, but maybe it affects how you view your ability to go to the store or not go to the store to get food. Again, this is regardless of your income. The sum and total of all of this is to say that my argument going into this was food insecurity in veterans can be about money in their pockets. Do they have it? Yes or no. But my argument is, if you feel that you are unable to acquire food that you want to acquire, that you are unable to eat the kinds of things you want to eat because of your injuries, that is a type of food insecurity. So that was my operating principle. I interviewed and administered a whole bunch of quantitative questionnaires to veterans with polytrauma who I recruited from three different service areas for three polytrauma rehabilitation centers, Palo Alto, San Antonio, and Tampa. I also interviewed polytrauma providers, so psychologists, occupational therapists, dietitians, nurses, and this was all in the spring and summer of 2020, so the height of lockdown, so people were home. So I had a captive audience. I was able to survey 43 veterans. I could only interview 37 of them, unfortunately. I really tried to get a good distribution of gender and ethnic and racial minorities. So that was what I ended up with. 17 had previously experienced homelessness. On average, they've been on at least two combat deployments. About a fifth of them had reported experiencing military sexual assault. They're just kind of the sum of the characteristics. I'm not listing all of them. We'd be here all day. Interestingly, four of them had clinically significant disordered eating behaviors. I also assessed them for that. 37% were food insecure. So remember when I talked about the 11.8% or whatever it was with veterans in 2021 nationwide, that's not an inaccurate statistic. It's completely accurate. But again, depending on which population of veterans you're looking at, it can really vary. That point in time COVID study I did, fully a third of veterans at that time were food insecure. So nine of them in this cohort had low food security. Seven had very low food security. So 16 were food insecure. Five were receiving any kind of food assistance. One was on SNAP, and four were mothers who were on the WIC program. If you're not familiar with WIC, it's for mothers with children aged five and younger who receive vouchers for specific kinds of foods at the grocery store. So this gets back to veterans who are food insecure are much less likely to seek nutrition assistance than non-veterans. I'm sure you have your reasonable guesses as to why that is, but the big one is going to be stigma and kind of this military cultural value that says that veterans don't. And I've had multiple veterans say this to me, veterans don't get food stamps. That's just not a thing they're going to do. And I'll get more in depth in that in a moment. So if I really had to boil everything down, for the veterans in this cohort who are really struggling, and by struggling, many of them said, I would always ask them, like, how's your life been since you left the military? And by the way, on average, most of them had been out like 10, 15, some even 20 years, because a lot of them were deployed just after 9/11. And they would say, every year that I'm alive, my life is worse. So things for them were getting worse. Not all of them, but the ones who were really struggling. And their self-perception in one phrase is really, I am my TBI. Their perception is there was my life before my TBI and there's my life after. And my life after, everything that's happened to me since, whether it's other physical conditions, mental conditions, my marriage falling apart, my job going away, whatever it is, it's because of the TBI. And then in talking to providers, the overarching theme was everything is about who they used to be. So there's this notion of I used to be an operator in a field of operators, and now I am this broken thing before you. It may seem like I'm using very strong language, but these veterans had a lot of strong language to share with me, and I really encourage them just to tell me how you feel. This is judgment free. If things suck, tell me that they suck. I want to know. Again, because I love a visual. If I had kind of a seesaw where people, the things that are really associated with core nutritional functioning would be things like poor, unhelpful experience with care. You know, a lot of people say, I don't like the VA, I had this experience, this doctor was mean, whatever it was. That's valid. That's going to make them less likely to seek more care. Viewing themselves really as this before and after binary. This core belief was surprising to me that broken, a lot of them, I would say, how do you describe yourself? Broken, that came up over and over and over again, is absolute and forever. That there's nothing that can be done, absolutely black and white. Really damaging experiences regarding weight and fitness. You know, the approach to nutrition in the military is military readiness, and I can understand and appreciate that. That is not adaptive or good way to approach life after military service. If I had a whole other career in the VA, I would do a lot more on how military service really teaches a lot of disordered eating habits and body dysmorphia. So really common to hear veterans talking about drastic measures before they get weighed, things like doing colonoscopy prep with magnesium citrate so that they'll lose a lot of water weight 24 hours beforehand. These things are, you know, from my point of view, they're disordered, but you have to make weight, and that is the most important thing. That ties into, it has to hurt to be effective. It's that no pain, no gain mentality that really drives a lot of their decision-making. Isolation, a lot of them were very socially isolated. I've never had so many people tell me that they love COVID because they didn't have to talk to anybody, they didn't have to see anybody, and nobody expected them to go anywhere. And they're like, it's the best, I never see anybody. And then lack of purpose. So again, it's that like, I used to be somebody who accomplished things, I used to get things done, I don't have a reason to do anything now. Those are the ones who are really struggling. The ones who I would say whose nutritional functioning is better is they're really adaptable to a way forward. They see themselves in a wider context. They understand the course of life. I was really amazed by how many veterans, and again, I'm not diminishing their injuries. You know, a lot of them will be in their 40s and they have really bad joint pain due to their service. I'm in no way negating that, but some of them will say, well, I never used to have to like write down a grocery list. I could just go to the store and I knew what I needed. And now I have to write things down. They say, yeah, that's, I write down my grocery list. Like that's the kind of this notion of like, this is because of my injuries. It's like, no, that's called you're in your 40s or your 50s or what have you. Because I didn't say it that way, but part of me was like, did you know that aging is a thing? Because aging is a thing. Mindfulness and learned coping strategies. So the ones who had sought out VA care for things like PTSD would often talk about how helpful it was. It was so helpful for that hypervigilance and going into public spaces. You know, when they go into a grocery store, they don't get anxious because there's somebody walking behind them down the aisle. Things like that. Family, social, peer support. We all know this. Having social support, we are social animals, makes everything a lot easier. They also have really internalized this value that seeking help is not weakness, and that's hard for all of us. We live in a very individualistic society. And then that small gradual steps are not weakness. I interviewed an occupational therapist who talked about veterans who would say, I got to get back into the gym, I got to lose 30 pounds, I got to do this. I used to bench press X number of pounds. And it's like, okay, so you know, when you go in, don't try to bench press that whatever it was, 200 pounds, start with this, the weights at this much, and then move it up. And it's just in one ear, out the other a lot of the times, because in their minds, I used to be a person who bench pressed this much, and they would go up to the weight machines and do it and immediately injure themselves and then come back to the OT and say, see, I can't work out anymore. See, because I can't do it. And then also an awareness that there is no silver bullet. You know, if you work as a dietitian, I have a lot of people who are like, well, what do you do to lose weight? It's like, well, here's that one thing that'll be $5.99, please. Like there's no one silver bullet for anything. So if you recall this social determinants of health definition that I really like, when it comes to veterans, I kind of thought, well, I would add something. I would say, if you struggle with your mental health, have an extensive trauma history, are socially isolated, have not had access to education, have internalized stigma, have experienced bigotry and or discrimination, have acquired maladaptive coping strategies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a way of saying that there's a lot going on here that you can't fit into a simple definition. So what is nutritional functioning? I'm finally answering that question. So after all the interviews and analyzing it with my wonderful collaborators and mentors and going over all the themes that you do in qualitative analyses, it really boiled down to five what we call constructs. So food background is the totality of life experiences that bring you where you are. Whether it's military, what you ate as a child, if you consciously don't eat as an adult the way you were brought up eating as a child, that's still your food background. It still informs your choices today. Your nutrition knowledge. So some veterans have never learned anything besides, you know, they dimly remember a class on the four food groups, depending on their age, from back in high school. And then some will really follow a lot of social media influencers, and those are the ones who are always telling me that they need to be on testosterone and on the keto diet. Meal aptitude. So this is the degree of familiarity, comfort, and engagement in the process of making food. I want to be really clear, this isn't about who does it in a household, especially, I'm going to generalize, older male veterans married to women. Meal preparation is still a highly gendered activity, so there's a lot of, well, the wife does that, and that's fine, but meal aptitude is like, are they able to do this? What is their level of comfort with it? And then resource navigation. This is resource navigation, but I also think of it as just money management tied to internalized stigma. So a lot of veterans will talk about how when I got out of the military, I'd never opened a bank account. I'd never set up a utility bill. I'd never had a savings account. I didn't know how to do this. I didn't know that, because the point of being in the military is they take care of those things, because your job is not to worry about that. Your job is to do the mission, right? And so a lot of them don't have that financial literacy backing, as well as this notion of like, well, what do I do if I do need help? What do I do if I can't get enough food? How willing or comfortable are they to seek out assistance? And then last one, and this is a big one, is navigation to enough food spaces. So what are the barriers to them actually going into spaces? So again, with that PTSD aspect, I've heard veterans say, whether it's physical, I'm having a bad back day, so I need food, the fridge is empty, but I'm not going because it just hurts too much. There's the, I'm too depressed to leave the house. There's the PTSD where I've had multiple veterans say, I only shop the perimeter of the store because I can't go down an aisle because I can't monitor both exits and entrances to the aisle. And I need to be able to monitor that. Or if I go to the checkout line and there's somebody stands behind me in line, I can't handle it. I give up. I leave my cart and I leave the store. It happens a lot. That again has nothing, that's not food related. That's nothing to do with food or food security. That is completely a psychological thing. And then also the cognitive barriers with TBI. So some say, you know, I made the list. I did the thing I was supposed to do. I have my list. My doctor said I should eat whole grains. So I went to the bread aisle and there's 5,000 kinds of bread and I can't handle it. And so I just give up and leave and I don't buy anything. So that's in a nutshell, those things. Just this week, yay, finally, my paper on this operationalization of nutritional functioning has been accepted for publication. Right now, this is where I'm at in step two. I've just finished step two. So I developed a questionnaire of over 100 items where I took those five constructs and, you know, asking things. These were all Likert scales. So, you know, do I strongly agree, some neutral, disagree, strongly disagree. And so things like, sometimes when I start eating, I feel like I can't stop. Or as an adult, eating meals with others is important to me. Or I'd like to do more meal prep, make something so that I have leftovers for the week. Or I can follow a simple recipe to make a meal. Another one might be, I don't think I'd ever use food assistance. That's for people who are really struggling. I had several veterans who I interviewed who were food insecure, according to their USDA measure, tell me, if a veteran tells you they're food insecure, they're lying to you. They're trying to get free stuff. Mm-hmm. So that stigma is really powerful. I piloted this measure in 270 veterans, more or less, and really tried to capture what are the items that really measure nutritional functioning. Because I don't want to go out and give veteran surveys of over 100 items. They'll throw it in my face, and with good reason. So I want to get it down to a much shorter, easy to digest survey. So the next steps, this is where I'm at now, is I'm working in the analyses on taking out unneeded items. And within the next month or so, I hope to start recruitment on piloting this new shorter version of a sample and going through the process of validating the results. So next steps, what do I do with the measure? I did all this, I spent all this time, I define nutritional functioning, who cares? I have a measure, who cares? What do you do with it? So the next step is implementing it in different settings. If you're familiar with Healthy Teaching Kitchen, which is a fabulous program, veterans come in to learn basically about how to cook. It's culinary education, or outpatient dietitians, or maybe whole health, or different outreach programs that are being developed right now by the Food Security Office, where my idea is that I give this short measure to a veteran and I see where they're at, because that will determine where they go next. So what sort of intervention is needed will align with their goals and values. And I know I'm short on time here, so I'm going to try to finish up real quick, I promise. So I want to just take a couple of minutes on this, is because for some veterans, it really is nutrition counseling. I think that a lot of veterans think that a dietitian will just wag their finger at them and say, I told you not to eat that. And that's not what dietitians offer. They offer a lot of counseling. A lot more is available now on things like mindfulness and eating, and acknowledging just the sheer emotional and psychological and cultural and social backing that determines why we eat what we eat. So maybe that's what a veteran needs. And maybe they need to go to see a dietitian because they just need somebody to walk them through the SNAP application. Maybe it really is just about they need some financial assistance. Do they need culinary education because they've never boiled water and they never had to cook anything in the military? And a lot of veterans really don't know. Financial literacy. So is this about budgeting for food? Food prices have gone up recently, as we all know. How do you navigate all of that while also meeting your other financial responsibilities? Is it transportation or mobility? So maybe you live across the street from a major grocery store, but you have mobility and chronic pain issues that make walking there really difficult. Then that's no longer a do you have food to eat problem. That's a transportation and assistance problem. The targeted PTSD treatment. So like I was saying, the hypervigilance in public spaces. Every veteran I've ever spoken to has told me that if they go into a restaurant, they will not sit where they have their back towards the entrance to the restaurant. They have to have their back to a wall. And then eating disorder intervention. This wasn't clinically diagnosed. I was just surveying them, but a lot of them have what I would call, not to pathologize everything, but kind of disordered binge type eating. My life is terrible. My life sucks. Everything hurts. All I can do here is sit and eat. Peer support, body image. This is not a real course, by the one, Body Image and Food Myths 101, but I dream of creating one where I just dispel a lot of the garbage nutrition myths that are out there in our social and news settings, where it's like, no, that's not what that means. No, you don't have to like kale. It's okay. You'll be okay. You're not going to die. No, keto doesn't solve all of your problems. So I'm not trying to be flippant, but a lot of it is just like, no, that's not true. That's not true. So resources and things to keep in mind. So nutrition and food services, this link shows you the types of counseling a dietitian can provide. Again, it's not just a meal plan or counting your carb grams. There's a lot more that dietitians do. The Food Security Office is relatively new, so they are forging ahead with all kinds of plans on different initiatives that target some of these things, including rural veterans and women veterans. Healthy Teaching Kitchen, as well as their YouTube site where they have demos. They're leading classes all the time nationwide. This is a colleague of mine at the MIREC. This is a resource for financial literacy for veterans. This is really, really tied to food security for obvious reasons. I don't have to give you the link to Whole Health, but there it is, because everybody knows it. And then the polytrauma system of care. So there's a lot of information there about veterans with polytrauma. The last couple of things is just things to keep in mind. Everyone has a food background, like I said. Veterans are interested in food and nutrition, regardless of their food security status. It's not just like, oh, well, if they're hungry and then they're fed, they're no longer interested in any other aspects of nutrition. They are. People's eating habits and identity are intertwined more than ever. Veterans will anticipate that telling you, whoever you are, about their eating habits will bring on moral judgment. And so I always say, like, you can tell me. You can tell me. I don't care if you ate the whole bag of Skittles. It's okay. You're not a bad person. And then black and white thinking along with that is a trap, especially when it comes to diet. So this is a quote I like. You have a relationship with food. It may be good, bad, punitive, complicated, pragmatic, emotional, dismissive, anxious, perfunctory, intellectualized, easy, contradictory, but you have it. And it says something fundamental about your relationship with yourself and your world. And that was said by Kimberly Wilson, who is a psychologist, and I like to bake, and she was a finalist on the Great British Bake Off a few years ago. So, and she has a fun little Instagram page. So thank you. I know I didn't leave much time for questions, but here we are.
Thank you so much. This was such an awesome talk, and thank you for the resources. I am going to turn it over to Dr. Janet Clark for the Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation Perspective, and then please put some questions in the chat.
Thank you, Diana B., and thank you, Diana. but kind of another Diana B. First of all, I just want to really express so much gratitude to you and your team for finding this remarkable mechanism for helping us to shift and hone our perspective on nutritional functioning. And when you think about the complexity of this and how many layers of this, because I was kind of noting this, because I had actually forgotten that the title of the talk was Nutritional Functioning, because you were going through this beautiful outline of food insecurity. And I think you said nutritional functioning at 11:28, and you've got definition 11:40. And this is why, I mean, this beautifully illustrates why every piece of what you said was necessary as foundational to talking about nutritional functioning. Like, it is incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. And just from the standpoint of the Office of Patient-Centered Care and Cultural Transformation, and our office's very deep commitment to using all the whole health system transformation to support social and structural and even systemic drivers of health and well-being, the value of your work just on its own can't be described, but the value that this brings, I think, to our office, to the work of Whole Health, and how it motivates our work is also just way up there. If there was ever a story or a template for how transforming our system is needed and how we have to look more deeply at individual person and their own needs and culture, like, this is that story. And, you know, this opportunity to deepen our perspective on the complexity and the nuance that supports whether or not someone is able to nourish their body in a way that is going to support their health and well-being, this story is just very needed and very welcome. As a clinician who took care of, my work was really in doing therapeutic education for veterans who were experiencing very complex medical pictures, usually chronic pain, mental health challenge, and many other medical complexities, polytrauma and TBI, often a part of that. I will say that the immune, cardiovascular, metabolic challenges that resulted from low nutritional functioning and so, you know, touch all the things that you touched on in your amazing talk, and how therapeutic education and a therapeutic presence can support shifts there. It was work that we've seen in Iowa City with the Therapeutic Lifestyle Clinic, and I just see that this is the moment for this work to begin and for this work to be highlighted, because as you say, there are, you know, dietitians do so much more than recommend grams of carbohydrates and what to eat and not eat. Mm-hmm. So just incredibly impactful. I also feel like it's going to be phenomenal for us to get to connect with our coaches, mm-hmm. and wellness coaches and our veteran partners, because I think their awareness on this, because they touch so much on the social lives of veterans. And so getting this information and this perspective to them is going to be very important for the future. So just a profound thank you. Thank you. This is fantastic. And I know NFS, our NFS colleagues too, are very dedicated to this line of work and thinking.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is great, Janet. I was thinking the same thing about whole health coaches and all the different ways that people within whole health and, you know, primary care and you know, mental health clinicians could get involved. There was one really great comment and question that I want to read. Mm-hmm. The idea of, I am this kind of person that eats this food was a light bulb moment for me. What resources do we have available to support the cultural shift to address this among veterans?
That's a good, the greatest questions are the hardest. So what resources? I think that, you know, to some degree, on a one-on-one basis, dietitians are already doing something about this, because, you know, dietitians do motivational interviewing. So there, again, it's not that didactic top down. It's what are your values? And so it takes time. But when you talk to a veteran, and again, I'm generalizing, but, you know, I was surprised when I was working with the homeless domiciliary that I had these young veterans who have, I would argue, a lot of really competing acute demands in their lives right now. But they're like, I want to go out on dates. I want to look good, however I define that. And my notion of what looks good is I need to spend money I don't have on these, like, muscle building supplements, and I need to do this to do this. Like, that is where his mind is at. This is what is important to him. It is not my job to be like, well, whatever, you're homeless, don't you have other things to worry about? Like, no, that's not what he's focused on right now. And so how do I validate that while also guiding and getting him not to spend money he doesn't have on a scam, basically? So that's an individual resource that you get with someone like a dietitian. Culture-wide, I mean, whole health can deliver that. I think that, you know, that's something I want to explore with Healthy Teaching Kitchen. I'm working with Robin LaCroix, who's the director, and Hillary Markey now, they're also on board with Healthy Teaching Kitchen. But we really don't have this sort of, that's a culture shift that I think is in some ways very recent. Mm-hmm. You know, the negative aspect of that is, I call it a woman alone laughing with salad, where if you Google images, like, there's all these, like, white thin women eating salad, and they're so delighted by themselves that they're laughing, right? All these kinds of things where it's this, we now use food very, and I'm not trying to get into a whole, like, I'm not a sociologist, but, like, we signal our virtues, our values, our political stance by what we eat, right? There are some people who are like, if they tell you what they eat, you're like, oh, well, now I know how you vote. I know where you stand on issues X, Y, Z. I know all of this because you're broadcasting what you eat. I know that's not exactly what this person was asking, but that's sort of like the dark side of that. With veterans, it's really getting into, if they say, like, I need to be a person who eats this, like, well, okay, tell me how you arrived at that. But I can't answer that in terms of, like, there are no wider resources.
Sorry. No, this is excellent. Well, I wish we could keep going on, because this is so fascinating. I'm going to turn it, thank you so much, Dr. Whitten. I'm going to turn it back over to Maria to wrap up, but great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for taking the time to prepare and present today. And for the audience, thank you everyone for joining us for today's HSR Cyber Seminar. When I close the meeting, you'll be prompted with a survey form. please take a few moments to fill that out. We really do count and appreciate your feedback. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So interesting. I am super, yeah. Great topic. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.